The title of my message tonight is Jesus Before Pilate and Herod. This is the 29th of a series on the life of Jesus. Pilate stood with Jesus on the balcony of the governor's quarters in Herod's palace, hard against God's temple in Jerusalem. Many charges had been brought against the Galilean, but he had answered nothing, not a word. The foxes from the temple knew very well that Pilate would not be satisfied with a death sentence if they told him the truth, that the accused Jewish prophet differed from them theologically, had called them hypocrites, and had attacked the traditions of their fathers. And the governor would only smile if Caiaphas complained that Jesus announced that he would destroy the temple and raise it again in 3 days, or that the kingdom of God had come. Pontius could care less if the Galilean were a false Messiah or not. Nor was he interested in their temple or traditions. So the high priest had turned the religious issue into a politically treasonous issue. The Roman had never seen a prisoner, innocent or guilty, not be defensive. And he certainly had never seen anyone hear so many charges brought against him, especially from a screaming mob who demanded his life and remained silent, giving no defense at all. Was the accused guilty of everything charged? Who would be honest and objective enough to accept such a wide range of charges not easy to prove? Mob charges are rarely accurate. Who would not defend himself against false charges? Yet this man stood, facing death for treason, calmly, without seeming to care to protect his life. What manner of man is this? The procurator turned his fleshly face to the silent prophet. Never had they met. A son of Shem and a son of Japheth, both sons of Noah, now worlds apart. The governor had a high Roman bridge nose and curly short hair, decorated with a wreath of leaves. He was dressed in a purple toga. The procurator asked incredulously, "Do you answer nothing? Do you not hear how many things they are charging against you?" But God's man answered not a word. Pilate had never gone unanswered before, and he surveyed the eyes and face of the accused carefully. The defendant's eyes were at peace. There was no defiance or bitterness, neither fear. And Pilate marveled greatly. He understood not such a man who possessed his spirit in peace amid such charges and in such a crisis for him as this. And the ruler from far off Rome truly admired him, but felt that it was folly for him to offer no defense at all. Turning to the crowd, the governor shouted, "I will try him in the judgment hall." And he made his way with his attendants to his red cushion on the same marble throne that King Herod used. Christ was led before him, still bound at the wrist, which was now very red and raw. But all could see that this precaution was unnecessary with this peaceable man. Nonetheless, the court remained, and a Roman guard stood on each side of the prisoner during the private interview. "Are you King of the Jews?" Pilate asked as he leaned forward on his throne, not knowing if he would get an answer or not. Jesus did answer, but he added a question of his own. "It is as you are saying. Are you asking this of your own accord in curiosity, or did others tell you this about me?" Pilate answered with a question and asked a question. "Am I a Jew? How could I ask this of my own accord? I don't keep track of Jewish sects. Your own nation and priest delivered you up to me. What have you done?" A strange question, and a futile one to ask any other man. But Pilate seemed to feel he could trust this non-defensive Jewish prophet king. He seemed noble and different than the others of his nation, or of any nation for that matter. The man of God answered the man of Caesar, "My kingdom, of which I am king, is not of this world, and therefore it is no threat to worldly kingdoms such as yours or Caesar's. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, the same as yours do. For every kingdom seeks to protect itself against opposers. And my servants would fight in order that their king be not delivered up to the Jews. But now, at this time, my kingdom is not from here, therefore we don't fight." This almost made sense to Pilate. He is a religious king of Jewish spiritual philosophy in some fanatical, ethereal way. But the word king was the central issue here. How could he be king if he dies? And yet he will not fight or defend himself that he might be king. What is this strange ideology? Not wanting to get into Jewish mysticism, but just to get the bottom line, Pilate asked again, "You are therefore a king." For he understood not how one could be a king here and now if he had no throne and kingdom here and now. "It is as you were saying," Jesus returned, "that I am a king. For this cause was I born, and for this I came into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth heareth my voice." And Pilate looked at the bound man and thought, this is a religious question. He is no threat to Rome or Herod. He is a religious fanatic like the rest of the Jews. But this one is the first noble one I've seen among them. He has something that his philosophy and dedication has given him that the others haven't. But he has now touched on a celebrated question, never before answered to the satisfaction of all, no matter how many times he went through the Greek and Roman courts of philosophy. Jutting his fat lower lip out in disdain at a new version of claim and truth, for who did not claim truth? The overweight Roman asked, "What is truth?" And without waiting for an answer, he rose and strode out to the waiting Jewish mob of accusers, a select group of religionists. The skeptical Roman had many times been present in Rome at the endless disputes of philosophers. And because he had heard so many contradictory metaphysical contentions and so many sophistical quibblings, he had become convinced that truth did not exist and could never be known. It was purely in the mind of the beholder, opinion and nothing more. Every man warred with his opinion against others' opinions, all called truth. But no one could ever act as judge and settle the matter. Hence the sword. It only settled the matter. The might of armies was law. Therefore it stood for truth. There were no absolutes. Pilate did not dream for a moment that this obscure Jew who stood calmly before him could tell him the truth. Pontius Pilate looked at truth and could see it not. Living truth that could make him a new man and give him peace in his heart and eternal life and joy never entered his Roman head. But Pilate was a materialist, an atheist. He could see nothing in a man who allowed himself to be captured, buffeted, and maligned. Pilate only understood outward strength. In his arrogance, he did not even guess what prodigious opportunity was his, a private audience with God's only begotten Son. Pilate was blind with an appalling and incurable blindness. He was lost and did not know it. But Pilate's mind was satisfied. This Jew was a harmless mystic, not a militant threat. These dishonest, panicky extremists who had accused him too, three times in fact, were not going to pressure him to rub out their innocent adversary. And Pilate was angry that they had disturbed him because of their envy, jealousy, and religious quarrel with this differing Jewish religionist. The governor from Caesarea now stood again before the throng of Sanhedrin, priests, elders, scribes, Sadducees, and Pharisees, which took all the streets so that a few of the common people could get involved in the stormy session. Besides, the masses were busy with the Passover feast, and most of them were not yet informed about the trial that had been taking place for the life of the Anointed One of God. Very few of them knew that Jesus was before Pilate being accused at this very hour. Raising his hand to still the crowd, Pilate called out, "I find no fault in this man," ending the case before him, or so he thought. But the tumultuous crowd would hear none of this. "This man must die!" Demons raged with fury in them, and they cried with loud, insistent voices, "He is stirring up the people! This is illegal! The entire land of Jewry is infected with his dangerous treason from Galilee to Judea." Galilee? Did they say Galilee? That is Herod's domain. Mine is Judea and south to the Dead Sea. "Is this malefactor a Galilean?" Pilate called out, and the Christ-hating crowd affirmed it to be true. "A despised Galilean causing trouble in Judea, Pilate's territory." "Then take him to Herod," Pilate shouted, "for he is Herod's citizen and problem, not mine." And Pilate walked off, glad to be done with the case. Herod would either let him go or whip him. Pilate cared not, for he was no man of mercy, as many Christians today have imagined. Herod was in the same Maccabean palace as Pilate, and so the crowd merely shifted in front of another balcony on a different face of the main building, and waited as Christ was led through the long, ostentatious corridors to Herod's quarters. Now Jesus was before his fourth judge that infamous morning, and both the angels of God and Satan looked on. Herod Antipas was the son of that bloody hog, Herod the Great, so-called, by one of his five wives. He was the true son of his father, because he wronged his brothers as his father had wronged his sons. When his brother, Archelaus, his own half-brother, was accused by his subjects, he managed to have him exiled. He also robbed his older brother, Herod, of his wife. This dog began his reign at 17 years old as governor over Galilee and Perea, offering himself to Tiberius Caesar, who sat on the throne at Rome, to be a secret talebearer of his brother and Roman officials in Judea. On a voyage to Rome, he fell in love with Herodias, who was both his niece and sister-in-law, since she was the daughter of his brother Aristobulus and wife of his brother Herod. And not shrinking from the double incest, he persuaded her to follow him, together with Salome, the daughter of the adulteress. His first wife, daughter of Aretas, king of Nabatai, was sent back to her father, who therefore declared war on Herod Antipas and defeated him. This happened in the days of the Baptist. Herod had feared Jesus and had feared that he might be John the Baptizer, whom he had beheaded, come back. He had previously tried to drive him out of the land by threats. But now Mary's son stood before the fox, and Herod was now exceedingly glad, for he had heard much of this man. He was now in Herod's jurisdiction to do with as he, the king, pleased. Wonderful! A Jew of the Jews, who acted not as the Jews, now stood before the Jewish king who pretended to be a Jew but had not a drop of Jewish blood in him. For his mother was a Samaritan, his father an Edomite, or Idumean, from Esau, and a Horite chieftain's daughter from Mount Seir, a Semite. Herod professed the Jewish religion and attended their feast through a long underground tunnel under the temple court, built for his ease and safety. For although he pretended to be the Jews' best friend, he was in fact their hated enemy. Now Jesus, the Holy One of God, stood, as Herod, the wicked one of Satan, sat, in his ancient Hasmonean, Asiatic, Babylonian-styled castle, next to the temple wall. The king, dark-complexioned, with a high forehead and large bridge nose with short hair and beard, sat also with Roman wreath on his dark hair as being a Roman governor of the Jews. Antipas beamed, pleased with himself. Here at last was his chance to see Jesus do some notable miracles like those that had reached his ear by report. Yeshua of Nazareth, the chief guard announced, giving the king a sheet of parchment from Pilate's pen. Greetings to King Herod from Pontius Pilate, servant of Caesar and friend of Antipas. I send you Jesus of Galilee to be examined, for he is your citizen. He was brought to me by the council, who has found him guilty of inciting the nation to new riot, claiming to be their king. He is charged with treason, but I suspect this man is only a threat to their religion, not the state. But the matter is now in your hands, O king. Farewell. Herod beamed. Yeshua of Galilee? He asked. The Galilean gave no reply. I have heard of your fame. You are a miracle worker. A Jewish prophet from God, true prophet. Your king asked a show of favorable miracles from you. But Jesus gave not so much as a change of face to Herod. I've had much pain in my bowels and lower back. Heal me. And again, Jesus gave no indication that he even heard him. Seeing that this man was going to be uncooperative, Herod tried once more, this time by a threat. Leaning forward, looking very stern, he said authoritatively, "You are judged to be treasonous. I have legal power to release you or to condemn you. If I condemn you to death, Pilate will accept my judgment and carry it out. If you are indeed a wonder worker and healer, as I have heard, save yourself. Do me some favors, and I can do you some favors. We are both in a good position to gain by this encounter. But if you remain silent, you show your king and yourself disrespect, and you will prove the accusations that you are an impostor to be true. Don't be a fool. Your life for a favorable miracle or two. Miracles cost you nothing. Dead prophets do no miracles. Your freedom is before you. Choose." But Herod Antipas saw the implacable statue before him was unmovable. And he shouted in a tantrum, "I command you as your king, do me a miracle in my body." But God's apostle moved not a muscle. And Herod stood enraged. The prophet John had made him rage by his accusations, this prophet by his silence. Herod's heart fought with itself within his ribcage where it was imprisoned. And it smote him, for he knew that his sins made him unworthy of the prophet's healing power. And yet he healed the riffraff of the land without question. Was he, the king, lower in the sight of God than the scum of the land? He was this Jew's king, and here a condemned Jew was snubbing him. Herod was deeply angered by the truth that bore down upon his wicked but believing mind. This was God's anointed prophet. Therefore, his judgment was true. This non-Jew pretender was outside of God's covenant, and all his sacrifices in the temple availed nothing. Demons of pride, rage, vengeance, retaliation, sadism, and hate flared up within him in manifestation. He would show this dog of a Jew who was top man. He had given this dumb statue a chance, and he would not take it. Who does this peasant son think he is to withstand the king of the Jews? So, you answer not a word, Herod screamed. All right, then I will hear your witnesses against you. This will open your mouth and loose your tongue. Take this dead dog to the court. I will examine him in sight of the Sanhedrin that condemned him, the ruler ordered. And the Son of Man was led to the open square behind the pillars, up a few steps from the intersection of the crowded street. Attendants set a large carved wooden chair down and set a large red cushion upon it for a seat, and other pillars were set within to cushion his fleshly body. A mitre was set upon his head, and he smiled with assurance, knowing his power and knowing that the crowd before him were cooperators with him in Rome. This man has been sent to me by Pontius Pilate to examine. What does the Sanhedrin say? Herod began. He deserves the death penalty for subverting the nation and turning them away from Moses and the law. He has turned Galilee, Perea, and Judea from our traditions and the teachings of our rabbis. He has threatened to destroy our temple, which you have so wonderfully built for us, O our king. He has incited insurrection. He claims to be Messiah. He's an imposter and false prophet. He casts out demons by Beelzebub, for he gets his power from him. He's an evil antagonist of our nation, posing as a giver of light, as he tears down our whole civil religious structure. The high priest cries out, do you deny it? Herod fires at Jesus, knowing that the true prophet is not an imposter, but he also fears his power and popularity. Jesus gave no answer. Herod turns to the throng of elders and says, he does not deny it. He claims to be the Son of God himself and is therefore guilty of blasphemy, the agent Annas shouts, knowing that to Herod this was a point he understood well. True, Herod shoots at Jesus who stands statue-like, for he has made his decision in Gethsemane, and knowing his father's will, he would not do anything to alter it. He forbids taxes to Caesar, a voice cries out. He is a wine-bibber and a drunken fop and a friend of lewd women, another voice cries out. O King of the Jews, hear me, a scribe says as he advances and stands upon one step from the pavement. This Yeshua of obscure Nazareth claims that he is the King of the Jews, not you. Suddenly a demonic grin crosses the face of the king, and he bursts into a red-faced, hysterical laughter as he rolled around on his big bottom on his huge chair, clasping his hands over his belly. Tears begin to hop down his fat Edomite Sumerian face as he laughed. So this dumb one who cannot speak or do wonders, a woodworker, is king and not I. Good! Very good! And Herod roared with laughter, and all the throng obediently joined in with him in the joke, even though they were too upset to feel like laughing. Well then, if he would take my place, let him be clothed in purple, Antipas commanded, sending a servant racing for the finery department in the building. And he needs a scepter to rule, does he not? Herod gleefully asked. And he held out a scepter of authority to a Herodian who took it, and seeing the king's intent and mood, swung it hard with a backhand, whacking the savior of the world in the side of the face. Here, O king, is your scepter, the puppet said loudly, and all laughed uproariously as the huge bruised welt swelled up into Christ's stalwart face that was set like flint. Here comes his robe, another Herodian shouts in glee, and it is flung around Christ's square shoulders. Another Herodian, a royal palace guard, jutted out his lower lip and sneered through clenched teeth, set in the face of hatred. So you answer not the king when he commands you. And he gave his fist to the mouth of the pure one who spoke only truth, and it bled and swelled up. But the true master showed no emotion to everyone's displeasure. And after much sport, Herod looked upon the bruised victim, who looked with sad eyes, filled with tears of sorrow that God's fallen sons, sons of Adam and Abraham, have rejected their only hope. And Herod's pride was satisfied. He now felt a tinge of fear and pity, rare for him. But he felt better now, his rage mollified. Herod could do no more. The man was righteous, he knew, but he was a troublesome thorn to Israel. He did not deserve death, nor was it Herod's to give. Herod stood and announced, I return this accused man to Pilate for his pleasure. And the Jews groaned. for they had hoped for more from Herod than Pilate, and for more than this. Herod Antipas returned to the palace and picked up his quill, dipped it in squid's ink, and wrote, "My dearest friend, procurator of Judea, friend of Rome and Herod, Pontius Pilate, today I have examined Jesus of Galilee, whom you have sent to me, he being a citizen of Galilee. I have questioned him, and am inclined to agree with your thoughts concerning this Jew. I am returning him to you for your jurisdiction, for his recent tenure has been in Judea, for also his arrest in person now is, where you have jurisdiction." And with this, Herod got rid of this embarrassing Jewish prophet, that inside he feared to treat as he had John the Baptizer. For his spirit had not been at ease for beheading God's prophet, whom he acknowledged to be from God. John had made him furious, so had Jesus. Yet he secretly believed in both, but not with his heart, only with his head. It was a relief to give him back to Pilate. And in this double action of sending Jesus from the governor of Judea to the king of Galilee and back to the governor of Judea, healed the rift between Herod and Pilate, and their hearts were now reunited. An enmity had arisen when Pilate ordered the zealots in the court of the men of Israel to be slain, for they were Galileans. Herod felt that Pilate should not have ordered his troops against Herod's citizens without his approval. His subjects were his, no matter where they were. Herod had said, "Procurator, if Roman citizens are under Roman law and protection everywhere, and if no nation may put them to death, then why are not Galileans under Galilean law and protection everywhere?" And Pilate had answered, "Because, O king, it is my duty to Caesar and my orders from him to control Judea. Rome rules the entire world, including Galilee. If it were a civil matter, I would have delivered them into your hands, but it was a matter of the safety of Jerusalem, which is in my power." But Herod still felt miffed and lightly esteemed and overlooked and put down. And he disagreed, saying, "But we are in the same building, right next to the temple. When you were informed of the disturbances, you could have immediately notified me, and I could have sent Herodian troops to quell the disorder." But Pilate had retorted that Romans who had more experience and skill were needed because of the number of fanatical Galileans involved. But this hurt Herod the more, and he answered that such a decision was his. Besides, he could have given Pilate permission to use his troops. But the matter was his to decide, not Pontius Pilate's. Pilate had put to death his subjects without his approval. And so proud, arrogant Pilate and proud, arrogant Herod had used careful words with each other, but a bitterness and an enmity had developed between them over this question of jurisdiction, according to the scriptures. But now Pilate had sent this Galilean to Herod. And Herod saw in this Pilate's admission that Herod was right, and he saw in this Pilate's belated willingness to let Herod have jurisdiction over all Galilee everywhere. This was not, however, Pilate's design in sending Jesus to Herod. And Pilate took Herod's return of Jesus to him to mean that he was no longer insisting on jurisdiction of Galileans who caused problems in Judea, but now acknowledged that Pilate was right. But that was not Herod's heart either. So the hot potato that was passed back and forth for selfish reasons became interpreted as being unselfish compliance, and the two hearts were healed that day. Then the procurator, Pontius Pilate, called the waiting chief priests and rulers of the people together and made a speech unto them. "You brought me this man as one stirring up subversion." And he waved his guard to show Jesus to the balcony, and he was thrust forward to the iron grating. God's son stood and looked out over his own subjects who received him not with pity. Pilate continued his speech. "Behold, on examining him before you, I found no guilt of the things that you are accusing him of, and neither did Herod, for he sent him back to me without a verdict against him. But you have a custom that I should release unto you one man at the Passover. I will therefore chastise Jesus and release him as that man unto you." And a great cry of protest went up from the Pharisees and Sadducees, for Jesus was not a champion of the Jews taken by Rome that they wanted back. But Jesus was the champion of the Jews, and the common people did want him back. But they had no say in this matter, for the Sanhedrin had filled the square and street with their men. Now this custom, Grotius says, was introduced by the Romans for the purpose of flattering the Jews. The Roman and Greek custom was to release political prisoners on the birthdays and festive seasons of the emperors to make him more popular among the people. This custom was introduced among the Jews to soften the Roman yoke. At the first Passover, Egypt let Israel go. This, therefore, seemed an appropriate day for a Jew to be let go. "Do unto us as you have previously done unto us," the Sadducees shouted. "Give us a choice of pro-Jewish, anti-Roman prisoners for us to choose from at this feast day." Pilate was convinced of Christ's innocency. The others who were arrested were clearly guilty. Therefore, Pilate had sought to release Jesus, but he lacked the courage to acquit him against the cry of the mob. Now, Pilate was no easy mark. He was as stubborn as the day in the field is long. Plus, he had convictions in this case, and he felt some admiration for the fanatic, for he was the first real man of peace, courage, and integrity that he had ever seen. And he had no desire to placate these envious, dishonest Jews. And he had contested them hard before, and had refused them in their insistent demands, emissaries to Rome or not. But the sand in Pilate's clock was running out, and he sensed it. It was getting dangerous to have another Jewish charge go to Caesar against him, especially one that said that Pilate would not deal with one guilty of causing nationwide uproars against Rome, even wanting to put a new king on the throne. And all the more when the Supreme Court and all the elite of the Jews were adamantly against him. And how would he explain to Caesar that Jesus was a harmless man when he admitted to being a king, having many subjects? And all the more when Jerusalem had demanded that he be king only a few days before. Pilate thought that the custom of releasing a Jew would be a safer way to go for him, especially in view of the public outlaw and outrage. So Pilate answered, "All right, I will give you a choice. Jesus of Nazareth is, by your own admission, one whose doctrine has filled the land and captured the hearts of the people. He therefore is a popular pro-Jew. And he has, by your charges, been seditious against Rome. Therefore, he is an anti-Roman. He is your first choice. I have another prisoner of the same name and category. Jesus, son of the Father, son of a preeminent rabbi the Jews called Father. He is a zealot leader of the Jews and was captured during an insurrection against Rome. He therefore is a Jewish champion and an anti-Roman. He is your second choice. Whom do you wish me to release unto you? Jesus, the son of Abba, or Jesus who is called Messiah?" Now the procurator knew that Jesus was sent to him out of envy only. He was not a real criminal. Therefore, the uproarious anger of the people, he imagined, must not be too deep. On the other hand, the Sadducees did not want zealots to topple their empire. And a notorious robber like Jesus Barabbas, who robbed the city to get wealth for his campaign against Rome, being a leader of a large, growing, dangerous, seditious cancer of fanatics, would be especially feared by the Sadducees, who wanted to hobnob with Rome, and by the Pharisees, who wanted to wait for the Messiah to deliver them, fearing Rome too much to let man take it into his own hands to revolt. The son of the famous rabbi might be a champion of the masses who were fomenting under the heel of Rome, but the masses were not now before Pilate. Surely, Jesus of Nazareth, the one envied by the priests, would be the runaway choice when compared to a dangerous robber zealot leader. There was another reason why Pilate wanted to release Jesus, one that made him willing to risk releasing Barabbas, who was dangerous to Rome as well as to the Jews. And that was the omen of the governor's wife, Claudia. The governor's wife had sent a note to him while he sat upon the judgment seat, judging Jesus. She, having heard in the palace who was now in examination, she had warned her husband, "Have nothing to do with that just man. Do not meddle with him. Leave him alone, for I have suffered many things this morning in a dream about him. I went through agonies of judgment upon us because of judgment brought upon him." Now, Pilate did not believe in dreams coming true, as his wife did. And yet, deep within his atheistic heart, he wondered if her experiences might have something true in them. There always seemed to be lots of examples and verifications of truth in the oracles and dreams that she and a superstitious group experienced. But neither one of them knew that this dream was from Elohim, the Creator and true God, the Father of Jesus, the God of the Jews. The chief priests, hearing mixed cries from the crowd, waved for silence. And stirring up the crowd to have one voice so they could get a choice, their strategy was not to brag on Jesus, the son of the rabbi, but rather to discredit Jesus the Nazarene. And they painted God's lily-white son black indeed. Then the high priest motioned to Pilate for a vote. Pilate, fearing the vote, tried to color it the opposite way, saying, "Would you rather, therefore, that I release unto you the king of the Jews?" He said it this way to contrast with Herod, present king of the Jews. Perhaps they would think that if the whole land had gone after the Galilean, they might be able to replace the hated Herod. Envied or not, Jesus couldn't be that bad to the Jews, he thought. But he misjudged these serpents who were so zealous for their own God, according to their program, that they were in fact clamoring for the death of their God's only begotten son. With one answer, the cry came back, Barabbas! Not this man, but Barabbas! Release unto us Barabbas! Away with this Jesus! And release to us the other, the son of Abba the Rabbi! Pilate, in his desire to release Jesus, dragged his feet on this matter. He had judged the religionists wrong. Never would he have thought that the Sadducees and Pharisees would choose a zealot leader over an envied prophet. Pilate was now pressed with releasing a man who was very dangerous to Rome. And Pilate did not want to give the Jewish leaders an innocent life. Not that that in itself was any big thing to Pilate. But this man seemed to stand apart from other men. It was hard to be totally unconcerned, for every man who has no interest in the matter does not want the innocent one to lose his life and the envious one to triumph over him. What then should I do with Jesus who is called Messiah, whom you call King of the Jews? Pilate asked, trying to place all the blame on the nation for what he knew that he was being crowded into doing. Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him! They kept shouting. Why? What evil has he done? I find no guilt in him worthy of death. So I will chastise him for the accusations you bring against him and release him. This was not the answer wanted by these ravening hounds. But Pilate wheeled about and walked off with, Crucify him! Ringing in his ears. A flogging is too light for the dangerous enemy of God himself. The high priest yelled as Pontius back went out of sight. By now, the crowd was swelling from the town that was hearing of the news, but it stood far away from the balcony. Obstinate Pilate had not surrendered to the howls of death, but his determinations were slipping. At any cost, he wanted to win his point. He would not give in to that rebellious, clamoring mob. He had not been successful in transferring to Herod Antipas the disagreeable responsibility of the death sentence, and he had not succeeded in persuading the Tigris and Mules people of the innocence of their humble king. What they wanted was to see a little blood, like Romans in the amphitheater do. He would satisfy them with a little blood and release them to zealot too. I will flog him, but will not take the life of an innocent man, the procurator said to himself. This seemed perfectly reasonable to his Roman mind. I will give this Jew enough punishment to satisfy the accusers. I will order him mocked as the king of the Jews before them all. They will have their theater and be satisfied with all that they can get from me. I will compromise with them. Pontius Pilate should have realized that he, having failed to save Christ or himself, could not placate the Jews, for the murder of their father, the devil, was in their hearts. They would not leave till they had a promise that the illegitimate son of Joseph would be fastened by four nails upon two beams of wood. These murderers would rather let the assassin robber zealot who committed murder in the insurrection live among them than the peaceable, pure, precious, perfect pearl of great price. The assassin was a patriot. The lover of souls was rejected as dangerous, treacherous, and treasonous. All reasoning having failed, Pontius Pilate resorted to an expedient that he hoped would quell the excitement of the popular frenzy of the bloodthirsty mob. He was now cowardly, seeking to save his life at the expense of another man's misery. Pilate was afraid he was committing an injustice. He was afraid of displeasing his wife, afraid of giving satisfaction to his enemies, afraid to put Jesus in a place of exonerated safety, afraid to have his soldiers disperse the arrogant, stiff-necked crowd, and afraid of losing his office. A real Roman, a Roman of antiquity, of true Roman stock, would either have satisfied the demands of the turbulent crowd and would not have wasted a moment in defending an obscure visionary, or would at once have decreed from the beginning that this man was innocent and was under the protection of the emperor. But by Pilate's stratagems, half-measures, hesitations, indolent questionings, and partially executed maneuvers, Pilate found himself drifting, being pushed toward a decision that he did not want to make. The Roman liked to roughly yanked off the sash and robe of God's anointed son and tied him to a pillar in the courtyard. And soldiers whom themselves had been flogged sometimes for small breaches of discipline saw nothing out of the way for the procurator to order them to scourge a delinquent of an inferior race. And they gave him the prescribed number of blows with enthusiasm, for he, being a Jew, symbolized all the trouble the insolent Jews had given them. Jesus was in the custody of the military governor, and his guards did not move his prisoner about on their own initiative. Pilate had told the chiliarch that he wanted a stage play for the Jews, and he specified what it was to be and why. The orders went down to the centurion and then to the soldiers. A dirty old soldier's cloak, once scarlet, but now being soiled with dirt and faded by the sun, looked purple enough to pass for a purple king's robe. This they put upon Jesus, and they took up a handful of dry thorns, kindling for the brazos of the night watch, twisted a couple of them together like a crown, and thrust it down hard upon his head. Roaring with laughter, they pushed him down into a seat and put a reed in his hand. One by one, passing before him, they bent their knees awkwardly, crying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" But the scenario demanded more than this burlesque homage. And so one of them struck a blow at the cheek, still purple, from the blows of the sinister Herodian clowns. And the Roman actor spit in his face and jeered as instructed. But this time Jesus, patient man, sitting holding the reed, was very tired. For he had not been able to sleep all night, and it had been a long, hard series of ordeals since he had entered Gethsemane the night before. Between fallen Lucifer, Judas, Annas, Caiaphas, Pilate, Herod, and their soldiers, he had endured a long, hard night and mourning. Now he sat praying for these soldiers, for that was all he could do for them now. Poor creatures, slaves of Rome, they hardly had a chance to be saved eternally. Pilate entered the scene and waved for the scourging to stop. Turning to the Jewish rulers, he announced, "There, behold the man. I find no guilt in him, but I have given you him scourged. Are you not now satisfied? Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" the bloodthirsty mad dogs cried from the street. Pilate turned the mutilated back of the prophet to the crowd, that they might see the welts and oozing fluid and blood. "Crucify him!" the mob shrieked. Annas waved to be heard and cried out to the Roman ruler, "A few bruises and practical jokes are not just and sufficient punishment for a treasonous enemy of the state, temple, nation, and God. There are trees in Judea, and you have nails to nail him to them. Do it, and fulfill your duty." And all shouted, "Crucify him!" Pilate was angry at himself and them. "You take him and crucify him, for I find no crime in him," he thundered back, exploding with emotion, knowing that they could not do so legally without his sword cutting their necks. Caiaphas waved for silence and yelled up to the Roman, "We have a law, and by our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." And Pilate became afraid. Afraid that maybe he really was a God come down to them. How could he dare crucify him? The Father God might punish him. Afraid that if he went against his wife's dream omen, he would find her dream of suffering come upon them. The governor was afraid of this charge that he, a Roman, did not well understand, but one that was held as blasphemy to the Jews and worthy of death. If he ignored their laws of capital punishment, they would surely lie to Caesar about him. The truth alone might even do him in, and these Jews could prove a lie to be true. And he was afraid that if Christ's kingdom were not of this world, he might nail Pontius Pilate in the next world to the cross in revenge. The governor felt trapped between Thor's hammer and his anvil. Pilate took Jesus again into the judgment hall, for it was clear that Christ would not talk in front of the salivating crocodile priests. "From where do you come?" Pilate asked, now much more believing than before, and much less sure of his own atheism. But Jesus gave him no answer. "You are not talking to me?" Pilate said. No one had ever dared to ignore him before, except Caesar. "Do you not know that I have authority to crucify you and authority to release you?" he asked, not at all understanding this strange prophet. But Jesus saw that he was having plenty of trouble with his authority in trying to release him, but he did not rub it in, but rather said, "You would have no authority at all against me were it not given you from above. Because of this, they who have delivered me up to you have the greater sin." God was allowing Pilate to be a judge of righteousness and justice, and he would be held accountable to God for right judgment toward his beloved son. And Pilate held this Jew in awe, as he did no other Jew, and he kept seeking ways to release him, but all in vain, for he sought to change the minds of timber-headed Jews who could not and would not accept anything short of timber and nails for God's lamb. A scribe shouted out boldly, "If you let this treasonous man go, you are not Caesar's friend, for anyone making himself out to be the king is speaking against Caesar." And Pilate saw his own neck in the noose, and he read the handwriting on the scroll of Caesar against him. The air was filled with threats, and Pilate could see that a riot was building, and that Rome would not stand for him allowing a riot in order to save a Jew, innocent or not. What was one Jew to Caesar? He sacrificed Romans and even family when expediency demanded it. Tiberius will surely have him deposed for this if it goes any further. A Jew was not at all important to Pilate, but this man was, for many reasons. Some of them were reasons the governor felt but did not understand. The rulers, seeing that a judgment was now necessary, had Jesus brought outside to Gabbatha, the pavement, called so because of the smooth, square-hewn stones, but it was an outdoor court of public justice where Pilate thought Jews might enter on the Passover week. Pilate, fearing to either let Jesus go or to crucify him, and thinking himself to be innocent of the blood about to be spilled, had a basin of water brought to him, and he attempted to wash off all his guilt before the Jewish God and his son and the nation, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this innocent man. See ye to it. This is your doing." And the Sadducees and Pharisees cried, "His blood be upon us and our children." And Jesus saw in a flash that it would be so, and he wept silently for them. Pilate, in resignation, gave orders to release Barabbas to freedom and to take the Nazarene to Golgotha's bare hilltop to be crucified. Now, what of Claudia Procula's dream? And what of Christ's claim? The Roman ruler could only hope that the water of ablution had done its work. It had not. The half-believing agnostic atheist heathen had in his final hour leaned upon a Roman religious rite of ablution over a Jewish cause, and he knew not how he stood. The wicked Jews cared not how he stood. They had their man at last. It had been a long, hard ordeal for them. But persistence had paid off. To God be all the glory. Now his cause would be saved. God had been with them, faithful in the end as always. Now they could get on with their week-long holy feast commemorating salvation for the Jews by God. The impostor was now out of the way. Let the Lord be glorified.